All right. Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. But I want to welcome my special guest, Mr. Dawit Kabidi. Sir, did I butcher your name?
Yeah, that is correct.
All right. And so he has more than 8 years of research experience in academic, not-for-profit and private industry. His previous research areas cover topics on trade, environment, consumer finance, and policy evaluation using statistics and economic model as a tool. Dawit worked for Kuna Mutual Group as a primary analyst for the Investor Guidance Center and Consumer Sales Channel of the TruStage Insurance Business before joining Kuna. Prior to that, he worked as a project coordinator of experimental research that compared the effectiveness of microfinance and on and on and on and on. Good morning to you, sir. And you here to talk about the economy and credit unions?
Yeah, good morning to you, Earl. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. And so let's begin first by talking about the value of credit unions. I am one who was in a union for 34 years, and my credit union, Prime Financial, who I'm still a member of, let's talk about the value of having credit unions, because sometimes I think people just don't realize the difference between having a credit union and a bank.
That is correct. So I'm glad that you brought that up, Earl. Yeah, so credit unions are established on the philosophy of people helping people. And then because of that, credit unions are democratically owned by their own members. So all their products and services are geared toward serving their own members. Entire earning that is coming from the activity is invested back into the credit union to help members get favorable pricing on loans and also favorable rate on their deposits. So the most distinguishing characteristic is that none of the money is, credit unions don't have shareholders, like none of the earnings go to the shareholders. So members get the benefit out of credit union activity. So members benefit the most out of it, whether it's loan or deposits, or even some members who like to build credit and get credit, credit unions are the best place for them.
You know, there are people, Mr. Kabidi, who in you know, poor neighborhoods, who don't have checking accounts, who are not affiliated with banks, who do business every day. And yet they only know about going to facilities that cash checks and charge them fees and charge them fees for everything. And they're not aware at all of the power of the credit unions. So you guys clearly are aware of that. What are credit unions doing to try to reach a massive group of people who don't even know the importance of the credit union?
Yeah, so I'm glad you read that. So actually, there is a credit union for everyone. So credit unions are spread throughout the nation. So anybody who wants to obtain the service of credit unions can go to yourmoneyfurther.com and they can find a credit union wherever they live. Like they can find the nearest credit union to them, and they will be able to create a checking account with a credit union. And that doesn't require a lot of fees. So again, like one thing that differentiates credit unions from banks is that credit unions charge lower fees for a lot of services. So when you compare credit unions to the alternative, they provide a very attractive and cheaper options for banking services compared to the all the other alternatives. So anybody can find a credit union near them. But we are also aware that, according to a study from the Federal Reserve, that 5.4% of American households are unbanked, meaning that they do not have a financial institution near them. So they usually get their financial services from alternative providers that charge them very high fees. These are, you know, cash checking institutions, pawn shops, and payday lenders. So credit unions are doing a lot to change that. So recently, the legislation passed for field of membership expansion so that credit unions can go to areas where banks cannot serve these communities and open a branch. So people will be able to find those, you know, as this movement continues, they will be able to, they can go to yourmoneyfirst.com and then find a credit union and then do financing cheaply. Get loans at a lower rate, deposit their checks at a lower, with a lower fee, without incurring a lot of service fees.
You know, when you talk about the service fees, and especially in the community where I live, and you see people who struggle, they don't make a lot of money as it is, and then they're caught in this trap where the little money that they do have, because they don't know the ins and outs of the banking systems, even the little money that they have is you know, just drained from them. And so, if they can understand the value of the credit union more so than even the bank, it'll stretch their resources even further.
Yeah, exactly. So, for example, CUNA recently made a strategic shift in its goal, and that shift is financial well-being for all. We know that there are a lot of Americans who do not feel that they are financially healthy, and these underserved communities is one area where CUNA has been actively working to expand banking services. That's why we are with the legislation that passed field of membership expansion will allow the credit unions to go into these communities and serve people who are subject to predatory lending, who are paying exorbitant fees for basic services. So it is very important that CUNA is actively working on changing that. And we also like, you know, talking to you, because, you know, we will be able to spread this message around where people can easily go and find a credit union that suits them.
You know, the predatory lending that occurs, and I've heard people say, well, you know, they've got to go somewhere, and you can't get mad at the industry for, you know, putting those title loans or payday lending institutions in the communities that could least afford to be built out of the few resources that they have. So credit unions are there, maybe, and people just don't see them. They're just not focused, or just not aware of them. And so, you know, it's not like the credit unions themselves have the resources to be, you know, on the, you know, radio, television, and the things that the banks can do. So, you know, I was more than willing to have, you know, you on, because the people that I'm around and the people in my community are the ones who are suffering from this.
Yep, definitely. So, I really appreciate that. And what CUNA has done to pass the field of membership expansion is also one area that we've been actively working to expand services, because, as you know, credit unions also had, you know, some restrictions regarding memberships. So, in a way, you know, we credit unions couldn't go to anywhere they want to do business and serve the people that they would like to serve. So this legislation changes that, and we are also actively working on awareness.
So
raise the awareness of the people for that.
So, excuse me, what is the legislation that you are referring to?
Wow. So there were, like, for example, you know, a cap in business lending, credit unions as our non-profit, our not-for-profit institutions, and they are established to serve their members. And they had restrictions on memberships. So, in, for example, in 1998, a community charter expanded membership, but there were still areas where credit unions cannot go and operate because there need to be some common bond for being a member of a credit union, and other legislations for that limits the activity of credit unions. So, for example, if like a cap in business lending were put preventing credit unions from serving communities, so that legislation changed that, and we will be able also to go to places and open branches where banks are abandoning areas because people in that areas are low income and not able to pay the necessary fees to open a checking account and get services from them. So that's what the field of membership expansion changes.
Dr. Ayan, this is Sandy Williams. I'm on this show Mondays and Fridays. I had a question. One of the issues I think that the people you're talking about, this audience of underserved with respect to banking services need is counseling, education with respect to bank services and also personal financial handling. Are credit unions staffing up and developing the capability to provide that kind of support to their members?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, 86% of credit unions provide some kind of financial counseling and education. They provide those services in different areas. It could be for people who are looking to buy their first home. Or it could be on areas of how to build up credit and become eligible for more loans. So yes, credit unions have financial education and counseling is one of the areas where actually credit unions reinvest in their own communities to help elevate their financial literacy.
You know, Sandy and Mr. Kabidi, just for those of us who don't know and aren't aware, all of these things, the banking industry, the credit union, financial literacy is lacking in communities where people struggle on a daily basis. It's not taught. And so people can become sacrificial lambs in a society that there's no, what is it, buyer beware? And so when people aren't aware, they can be taken advantage of. And so I can't say that I haven't in my life not ever have been taken advantage of. I have been for my lack of understanding, and it's why I know so many others who learn the hard way. Mm-hmm. But as long as the earlier you can get to children, right? I mean, financial literacy training should start when children are young, right? I mean, that's not something you wait until you're an adult to try to, understand.
Yes. I totally agree with you. So financial education has to be part of the main
curriculum.
Curriculum,
yes.
Yes. So I totally agree on that. People need to learn how to manage their finances as early as possible, because one of the things that we are seeing is people are struggling to manage their money once they join the labor market. So yeah, I totally concur with that. And in credit unions, our awareness program actually works hard. Like, they do a lot of campaigns. For example, April is financial literacy months for CUNA. So we do a lot of campaigns to let people know about the counseling and the education services that credit unions are doing and what we do to help people. So if I give you some statistics, so we have around 5,000 credit unions throughout the country, and 2,200 credit unions provide some sort of counseling. And another 2,200 provide education that lasts more than just a few periods of counseling services. There are 1,000 400 of them like have financial literacy workshops. Almost 1,000 provide first-time homebuyer programs. And some provide, you know, like how to manage credit and build credit. And some also provide online literacy education programs. So, yeah, credit unions reinvest in the community by doing that. But they also have various financial literacy campaigns to educate people about their finances. So, yeah, while I agree with you that, you know, financial education should be part of the regular curricula so that everybody is aware about it, but in this area, credit unions are doing a lot to change that, you know, until we get that curriculum in place.
Doctor, yeah, credit, Wisconsin has played a central role in credit unions, hasn't it? CUNA, you keep mentioning CUNA. What does that stand for, Credit Union National Association or some such?
Yeah, so Credit Union National Association is a trade association representing 5,000 credit unions.
And you're headquartered in Madison, right?
Yes, we are.
And I take it Wisconsin must have played a central role in the whole development of credit unions back when the credit union movement started, whenever that was, 80, 90 years ago?
So the movement, the CUNA movement, I think probably started in, when the association first established, probably it started around Denver, but I think it moved here in 1935. And then since then, we have been in Madison, and Madison has been, you know, the center of the credit union movement. CUNA being here, CUNA Mutual also being in Madison, and the World Credit Union Council is also located here in Madison. So, yeah, you are right. Madison has been the center of the credit union movement.
So when we talk about the importance of it, I recall early on, because living in Milwaukee and coming up during the time of the civil rights struggle and a time when in the city of Milwaukee there was redlining and people couldn't get loans, people of color couldn't get loans from the banks themselves, banking institutions, and the struggle that many of us went through who've been around a while, it was the credit union that gave many mm-hmm. blacks, even though they worked in industry, who were locked out of even being able to do banking on par with others. It was the credit unions that opened the door and gave the opportunity. And many people don't understand that it's been that kind of relationship with the black community, the credit unions, for a long, long time.
Yeah, so I think this, like, if you go back in history, credit unions, were first established because, you know, banks were not providing loans to ordinary folks for, you know, consumption, like, you know, housing and out.
Right.
That's why people got together and, you know, formed these financial cooperatives to be able to lend money to each other to afford a lot of things that they were not able to. But again, you know, considering again the history of the U.S. even before the civil rights movement, we all know that African Americans were, you know, prevented from accessing financial services altogether, and a lot of African Americans were able to get together and form their own credit unions to be able to do that to each other, for each other. And that is why, if you look at the percentage of membership across race, you can see that more African Americans are members of credit unions relative to their distribution in the entire population, and that is specifically because of that history. Credit unions have that history of, you know, including people that are excluded from the mainstream finance, and that's why the philosophy of, you know, people helping people also came to being. I agree with you on that, Earl.
You know, when you, I remember in Milwaukee going back to the 50s where there was a small black credit union that opened, Columbia. and savings. Mm-hmm. And so it was at a time that black people didn't own very seldom, couldn't get loans anywhere, and that credit union, my father would tell me, was the only lifeline that they had, mm-hmm. even though they worked just like everybody else and worked 5 days a week, had decent jobs, just could not get any credit to buy a home, to, you know, cars were about the most that they could get. But, you know, to this day, I'm a member of a credit union and, you know, trying to get my sons to follow suit and understand, yep, the value of that.
Let me leap in here. Just as a question, I don't belong to a credit union. Doctor, can anybody join any credit union now in Wisconsin, or do you still have to be a member of some organization that's connected to the credit union? I know, mm-hmm. I had an automobile loan that was purchased by Landmark Credit Union, and I think Landmark, mm-hmm. then began to reach out to me and ask me if I wanted to have a checking account and others. So it looked to me like, mm-hmm. I could join the Landmark Credit Union without any relationship with it to speak of. So what's the story now and under the law of Wisconsin? Can any of our listeners join a credit union?
Yeah. Great question. Yeah, absolutely. That's why I said at the beginning there is a credit union for everyone, and that's why I wanted to point your listener to moneyfurther.com, because they will be able to find a credit union for them. Yes, you know, membership restrictions in the old days, you know, like regulations like limited that. For example, you have to be a member of this, you know, working group. But, you know, a lot has changed then, because the laws have relaxed. And right now, we have set up a website allowing everybody to go there and then enter their address and then find a credit union that they can join to easily. So that's why I say there is a credit union for anyone now. You don't have to worry about, do I have to be a member of this group or that group? You will be able to find a branch near you by going into that website.
Well, I want to thank you, Mr. Kabidi, and we can do this again, because the information is a lifeline to people who sometimes are left out, and who can then live their lives with an opportunity. Sometimes all people need is an opportunity. The credit unions have provided that, always have and always will. You want to say what in closing?
Yeah. Thank you very much for inviting me. So I would love to come again and talk more about credit unions.
We'll do it.
I really appreciate it, Carl.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
All right, got to go to break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be back. You know... Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, Ukraine preventative strikes should hit Moscow forces in Russia. A former Ukrainian lawmaker who is saying that the United States is tying Ukraine's hands behind their proverbial backs by not allowing them to attack the mainland of Russia.
Well, it's sort of an interesting concept. We're providing them with the weapons, which essentially are their hands. And then he says, well, you're tying our hands behind our back. Well, we're providing you with weaponry. We are providing you with some restrictions on the use of those weapons. And those restrictions are designed to keep us from being dragged directly into the conflict. And, of course, the Ukrainians have nothing to lose by us being dragged directly into the conflict.
Right.
You know, they're in the conflict already, so their fat is in the fire, and they'd like to have our fat in the fire too, and so they have a different point of view than we do, and we have to be careful about that, and the American public has to be careful about it. I've been from the start of the view that we don't have the real political, the geopolitical interest in Ukraine. It's not a matter of critical import to the United States. There's this ideological view about democracy, but ultimately our foreign policy, where we commit troops, where we commit our treasure, tends to be premised on America's real interest and not ideological arguments. Furthermore, we're sending a lot of money to Ukraine without audit, and I think we need to worry some about that.
You know, Sandy, and it looks like we're not going to move off of center when it comes to whether or not we're going to get even deeper involved. I mean, even though there's clamoring that we should, Donald Trump, former president of the United States, said again this past weekend that the United States shouldn't have been involved in this whatsoever.
Well, you know, I don't like Donald Trump. I didn't like him as president. I have agreed with him on almost nothing. But the fact that I don't like him and don't agree with him on almost anything doesn't mean that I can't agree with him on something. And I do agree with him on that. I do agree with the notion that Ukraine should have negotiated with Putin before the invasion, should have been open to negotiation at least, and the United States should have understood what that negotiation was going to be, because the alternative to that negotiation has so far been a pretty terrible war and some very terrible outcomes for the world. And it looks like a negotiated settlement for the war is probably going to look a great deal like what could have been negotiated by Zelensky and Ukraine before the invasion. So, yeah, to be honest with you, I do agree with Donald Trump about that fact.
You know, Sandy, bottom line is, as this guy, Oblast George Tuka said, it's time Kiev.
Well, let me just straighten you. Oblast is like saying Milwaukee County. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Oblast is a region, is the word for region.
Oh, so Luhansk Oblast.
Luhansk Oblast is like Luhansk County.
Okay. So George Tuka said, it's time Kiev launched preventative airstrikes directly into Russian territory. And then he blamed the United States for tying their hands behind their backs and not allowing them to punish Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You just stated, if it wasn't for the United States, this would have been over.
Yeah,
right?
We have provided Ukraine with the capability of resisting, of essentially thumbing their nose at Russia and not negotiating. I mean, it's my understanding that basically Ukraine and Zelensky refused to negotiate with Putin at the time that troops were surrounding Ukraine and Putin was announcing to the world exactly what it was that he wanted in the way of an outcome. The only part about that outcome that struck me as being hard to deliver on was the notion that there had to be a change in who was the leader, you know, to change out Zelensky for some other leader. I suspect that could have been negotiated. That probably was an item that could have been negotiated, but it wasn't negotiated. There was no negotiation. And my understanding is now that since March, there has been no negotiation between Ukraine and Russia. And the reason for that is that Zelensky has said that he's unwilling to negotiate at this point, and he must be being enabled in that position by the Western countries and the United States, because we're continuing to not only provide him with munitions, but sort of up the ante and provide him with ever more effective munitions, like these HIMARS, which apparently have been sort of game-changing in the field of combat.
You know, Sandy, part of this appears to be almost disingenuous from the perspective of the West, because they know they're not going all the way.
Right. Well, like I said, in the very beginning, I said my fear was that we were going to provide them with enough support so they could fight to the last Ukrainian. And the notion was, and we've even said it on a couple of occasions, that what we wanted to do is weaken Russia's capacity to ever do this again. And we wanted to weaken Russia. And then there's been some lip service by Biden and others, kind of slip of the lip service when he said he wanted to get Biden out of office. I mean, Putin out of office. That was just maybe a slip of the tongue myself. I just think that there's a lot of disingenuous stuff going on with respect to the West position here.
But this is war. This is not some chess game, right? I mean, after all, it's not some chess game. People are dying.
Yeah.
Countries being destroyed.
Unfortunately, proxy wars feel like chess games when you're on the outside. You know, the proxy, you know, we're providing lots of munitions and money and probably profit to the industrial municipal defense industrial kind of complex in the United States is prospering out of this, but no blood's being lost of American blood. And so it's a proxy war. It's a bit like a virtual game as far as America's concerned.
So ask about the diplomatic risk of shelling Russian targets using weapons provided by NATO country. Tuca said the difference between weapons provided by Western powers and Ukrainian weapons is just a political gimmick. So, I mean,
like I said, they have little risk associated with America's fat getting in the fire. In fact, it would, if America's fat was in the fire, then we'd be in it on all fours by their side, total alliance. That's something they probably would like to lure us into. And as far as they're concerned, they're willing to risk whatever the consequence is as far as Russians' retaliation, because they think they're bearing the full brunt of Russian retaliation right now.
Well, so the arrogance of this guy, from the moment when any and whose weapons cross the state border of Ukraine, they become Ukrainian. From whom we bought it, how we got it, it does not matter at all. This is a political manipulation by the West and nothing more. I would think, Sandy, that if I'm Zelensky, mm-hmm. I'm finding this guy, and you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you know, politicians are free to talk, I guess, and so there's some goofy politicians, and this guy probably falls into the category of a goofy politician, because that might be true. The first time they use a weapon outside of our permission, I think their military experts understand it might be the last time they get that weapon. So, you know, they've got these HIMARS, but they don't have HIMAR rockets in an inventory pile. So they need to keep getting those rockets from us, or the HIMAR launchers are worthless.
You know, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be back. But they just keep on coming. What can I do to get on the right track? I wish they'd take some of these knives off my back. What they do? They smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers. Backstabbers.
This is Robert Pilot of Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake. On our show, we talk about native issues like treaty violations, protecting the water, and COVID in our native communities. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are native issues. We invite all people to walk hand in hand with us through our struggles, victories, and achievements. Join us weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Alliant Energy is a proud sponsor of Native Roots Radio.
Announcing Friday Night Live, broadcasting live from Waukesha and only on the Shaw 540 AM and 101 FM. Live music every Friday night, beginning at 6 p.m., broadcasting from the Five Points in downtown Waukesha. Friday Night Live broadcasting begins June 3rd at 6 p.m. and will play out all summer long. A special guest host each Friday night. Tune in for the music and variety, or come downtown to the Five Points and join the party. Friday Night Live only on the Shaw.
President Trump lost the election. Joe Biden won the election.
Collectively, Republicans got 1.661 million votes, 51,000 more votes than Trump got.
He exhausted his cases. He exhausted the court challenges.
All the Republicans voted for Trump the way they voted for the assembly candidacy. He would have won.
It was not rigged. It was not stolen. Donald Trump lost the election. Joe Biden won the election. It's really clear.
This message was paid for by the People for People People Corporation. Donate online at p4ppc.org.
The Devil's Advocates.
Mitch McConnell did make a public statement, right? After he voted to acquit.
No, nothing says the president can't be prosecuted.
Set the example for your caucus.
Convince your caucus as to why the man is not fit to serve. How do you not use your leadership? Say, you guys, this is crazy. We can't do this, and here is exactly why. Because now, of the two major political parties, one of them is under the thumb of a fascist insurrectionist.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk from Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. But Sandy, the more you, this Ukrainian situation, that people have just grown tired of it in this country, I think. We're not seeing out of it like we did early on, the photojournalists. You said once it got to a ground war, all of the video and all of the things that we were seeing early on, the tear-jerking kinds of things, the bodies that they would show, the graves, all those things before it got to the ground war that were just done through the rockets and whatnot. And you said once they got into this ground war, You've basically been right on point, right on target with it.
Well, you know, there's so many issues associated with the current situation in Ukraine, but the question really is what happens now. And one of the issues that America has is that it's been relying on the strength of the unity of the European Union with respect to its sanctions on Russia, and that unity is beginning to fracture. The UK, for instance, has been trying to work out a process for setting up a bunch of exceptions to the sanction on the restriction on gas imports from Russia, because everyone understands that if they really succeed in shutting Russia's gas down, the volume of oil, for instance, in the world would go down by the
Whatever percentage, 10 million
or 15 million barrels a day that Russia is exporting. Okay, that's a very big dent in the supply side, which would cause a worldwide increase in the price of oil, and it would last for as long as the sanctions
Which we
last.
Just got through experiencing.
Well, we're experiencing it now, and it would continue to experience it, and we haven't even cut it all off. There's still oil being imported into Europe from Russia. It's not absolutely shut down. And so then the question is, what happens with an absolute shutdown? And the fact is that it's not good from an economic standpoint for the West. So I think now the reality of all of this...
And more than likely not going to happen.
Yeah, not going to happen. So if it doesn't happen, you begin to see fractures in the alliance on the sanctions, and you begin to see fractures more generally. And so I think the United States and the West probably doesn't want that to happen. And the way to maybe make sure it doesn't happen is to have Zelensky enter into negotiations with Russia and to reach a negotiated settlement here that could drop the sanctions. Okay, because the sanctions are something that we did with some enthusiasm that was maybe ill-conceived in the beginning, the enthusiasm part of it. And now we're realizing the full brunt of it. And I think the understanding would be that we'd like to have a settlement of this that did not continue all of these sanctions that are painful to the West.
Well, you know, Sandy, it was... The sanctions were kind of done reluctantly, too. I mean, they didn't just broadly go about putting those sanctions in place. It was the more that people saw the American people started clamoring and crying out, the more they saw what was happening to, again, the news, television.
Well, the America, I think, put a good deal of pressure on Europe. The sanctions have its primary impact on the West, meaning Europe. The Western Europe, and they are the primary consumers of oil and gas from Russia, and they are the ones feeling the brunt of these sanctions. They initially agreed to the sanctions. All of those sanctions they agreed to were out in the future at the time they agreed to them, and I suspect most of them thought that this invasion and conflict wouldn't last long enough for the sanctions to all come into effect. So they were easy to announce and not so easy to absorb. And now they're at the point of absorbing them, and they're realizing the painful part of it. You know, the enthusiastic part came at their announcement, and now the less enthusiastic part comes when they have to feel the brunt of them.
Well, I can tell you that as an American who saw a $3.79 per gallon number, I was like celebrating $3.79. I don't think any of us want to see it go back up to where it was. And I don't think we make the correlation, Sandy, with, again, the fact that a lot of this is based on what's happening there. You know, because there are people who pushed right away to Republicans and said this was all Joe Biden. That's who this was. And the gas prices have gone up for all those reasons. You kept pointing at the time that this is bigger than just one man. And
well,
Democratic.
I mean, there's a problem in the United States, if it's a problem, but one of the restrictions on supply in the United States is the capacity to refine oil into gasoline. So, you know, at some point we reached that full capacity, and when we started exporting oil and oil products from the United States back to Europe, we created a more shortage in the United States with respect to gasoline, which in turn upped its price. So, yeah, we were actually feeling in a direct way the effect of the sanctions in Europe, because our oil and gas industry were profiting from selling oil and gas at a high price into Europe and therefore taking it off the American market.
So, Sandy, I did not know that, and I'm sure many of us did not know that. So, because we've been selling our gas, oil and gas, to Europe,
sure,
and we had become the number one supplier of that product, right? I mean, America got to the point.
The number one supplier of oil and gas to Europe was Russia.
No, I meant globally. We came.
Well, no, we are not the number. We are
number one and number two. We were moved up the line.
Well, not. Yeah, we were like the fifth or sixth in terms of our supply of oil and gas. We became
production?
Independent from
Saudi
imports and Saudis a couple of years ago with respect to our capacity to produce all of the oil and gas we needed within our shores. But we've always had an industry that was free to sell its oil and gas to the highest bidder, right? And so we have LNG plants, these liquefied natural gas plants that can take natural gas, compress it into LNG, load it on ships, and send it abroad. And we do that when the price of gas is so high abroad that it pays for the cost of transportation and provides a higher price for the gas than would be the case if it were just stuffed in a U.S. pipeline and shipped to Milwaukee or someplace. So, the price of oil and gas is a commodity, and it relates to the worldwide commodity price. And to the extent that transportation can be absorbed and the price for oil and gas can still be higher to a producer in the United States by selling it abroad, they'll sell it abroad.
So the natural gas problem that is going to crop up in Europe as the months get colder and colder,
yeah,
there's going to be more of a clamoring from those nations.
Sure.
Get it done, right?
Yeah, and their importation of LNG from the United States has gone up, and we're going to reach capacity in terms of the capacity of the United States to actually compress it into LNG and ship it abroad. We're going to max that out, and that's going to be taking gas out of the United States marketplace, increasing the price of gas. Almost every electric bill has a flow through on the price of fuel associated with it, so that the price of electricity has already gone up a good deal because the price of gas in the United States has gone up quite a bit. And when we start heating our homes this winter with gas, we're going to find out just how much more expensive that is.
So, Sandy, you just based on what you are saying, We shouldn't be looking for the gas prices to get back to where they were, $2 and whatever, because we're not out of this crisis yet.
Yeah, we're not out of the crisis yet. And we started this out by talking about whether Zelensky should be coaxed into negotiating with Russia. And I think we're now talking about some of the reasons why people like the United States and Western Europe should at least privately be thinking that what they want to do is talk privately with Volodymyr Zelensky to say, you know, you ought to start talking to Russia and see how you can settle this war, because we can't do this forever.
You know, Sandy, I know I don't want to go back to $5, but we're not out of the woods.
No, it the price goes up and the price goes down and the price can go back up again, and if Europe follows through with a total boycott, a total sanction on the importation of oil from Russia, the price of oil and gasoline in the United States will go up again.
All right, gotta go. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Sandy, as always. Thank you, Connor. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.